the isolation in the first place. That is not the sort of vicious circle that you want to characterize your life. The people I knew who finished their undergraduate degrees or trade programs were better for it. Not good, necessarily. Not functioning optimally. Not necessarily thrilled with their choices or devoid of doubt and misgiving. Not even certain to continue in pursuit of what they had studied. But far better than those who withdrew and drifted. The commitments and the sacrifices thereby entailed matured those who endured and made them better people. So, what is the conclusion? There are many things to which we might commit ourselves. A case can be made for the arbitrary and even meaningless nature of any given commitment, given the plethora of alternatives, given the corruption of the systems demanding that commitment. But the same case cannot be made for the fact of commitment itself. Those who do not choose a direction are lost. It is far better to become something than to remain anything but become nothing. This is despite all the genuine limitations and disappointments that becoming something entails. Everywhere, the cynic despairs are bad decisions. But someone who has transcended that cynicism, or more accurately, replaced it with an even more profound doubt, that is, the doubt that doubt itself is an ultimately reliable guide, objects. The worst decision of all is none. Discipline and unity. The discipline that enables concentration on one thing begins young. At a very early age, children begin to order the multiplicity of emotions and motivations that constitute their basic instincts of survival into the strategies of cooperation and competition that involve others, voluntarily, and children who are well constituted and fortunate manage this in a manner that is simultaneously socially desirable and psychologically healthy. When a child's self-directed experience is interrupted by the emergence of an instinctual system, when the child is hungry, angry, tired, or cold, the good parent steps in, solving the problem, disrupting the child's fragile unity, or, better yet, teaching the child to solve the problem himself. When the latter process has been completed with sufficient thoroughness, the child is ready to join the social world. This must happen by the age of 4, or it may never happen. A child must be sufficiently self-organizing to be desirable to his or her peers by the age of 4, or risk permanent social ostracism. A child who is still having temper tantrums by that age runs precisely that risk. The process of integration is furthered by peers, friends, for the child well-trained or fortunate enough to be accepted. When a child plays a game with others, she is disciplining herself. She is learning to subordinate all her competing impulses to the dictates of that game, one thing despite the potential multiplicity of rules. Learning to subjugate herself voluntarily to its rules and well-defined goals. To play in such a manner, she must transform herself into a functional subunit of a larger social machine. This can be interpreted as a sacrifice of individuality, if individuality is defined as limitless choice of impulsive gratification. But it is much more accurately development of individuality considered at a higher level. The properly functioning and integrated individual tempers the desires of the present with the necessities of the future, including the necessity of playing well with others. It is in this manner that the multifarious games of childhood temper the screaming cacophony of late infancy. The payoff for such development is, of course, the security of social inclusion and the pleasure of the game. This, it should be noted, is not repression. This point must be made clear, as people believe that the things discipline imposed by choice prevent us from doing will somehow be lost forever. It is this belief, in large part, often expressed with regard to creativity, that makes so many parents afraid of damaging their children by disciplining them. but proper discipline organizes rather than destroys. A child terrified into obedience, or shielded from every possible chance of misbehavior, is not disciplined, but abused. A child who has been disciplined properly, by contrast, by parents, other adults, and most significantly by other children, does not battle with, defeat, and then permanently inhibit her aggression. Such a child does not even sublimate that aggression or transform it into something different. Instead, she integrates it into her increasingly sophisticated game-playing ability, allowing it to feed her competitiveness and heighten her attention, and making it serve the higher purposes of her developing psyche. A well-socialized child does not, therefore, lack aggression. She just becomes extremely good at being aggressive, transmuting what might otherwise be a disruptive drive into the focused perseverance and controlled competitiveness that make for a successful player. By the dawn of adolescence, such a child can organize herself into ever more complex games, joint, goal-directed activities that everyone plays voluntarily and that everyone enjoys and benefits from, even if only one person or one team can win at a time. This ability is civilization itself in its nascent form at the level of the individual player and group. This is where both cooperation and the opportunity to compete and win make themselves simultaneously manifest. This is all necessary preparation for the more permanent choices that must be made for a successful adulthood. It is certainly possible and reasonable to have some doubt and to argue about which game might best be played here and now, but it is not reasonable to state that all games are therefore unnecessary. Likewise, although it may be possible to argue about which morality is the necessary morality, it is not possible to argue that morality itself is thus unnecessary. Doubt about which game is appropriate right now is not relativism. It is the intelligent consideration of context. The fact that happiness is not appropriate, for example, at a funeral, does not mean that happiness itself lacks value. Likewise, the claim that morality is both necessary and inevitable is not totalitarian. It is merely the observation that basic, primitive, unidimensional values must be subsumed under socially organized structures for peace and harmony to exist and be maintained. It was the bringing together of a warring multiplicity under the unifying doctrines of Christianity that civilized Europe. It could, perhaps, have been Buddhism, Confucianism, or Hinduism, insofar as the East is also both broadly civilized and unified. But it could not have been the absence of any doctrine whatsoever. Without a game, there is no peace, only chaos. Furthermore, the game that exists must be playable, as we discussed in Rule 4. Notice that opportunity lurks where responsibility has been abdicated. This means that it must be structured by a communally acceptable set of rules, by only those constraints that many people are willing to abide by for a long time. It is possible that many such games exist, theoretically, but it is at least equally possible that there are only a few. In any case, the rules of Christianity and the rules of Buddhism are by no means arbitrary, by no means nonsensical superstition, any more than the rules of a playable game are merely arbitrary or nonsensically superstitious. To think that peace can exist without the overarching and voluntarily accepted game is to misunderstand the ever-present danger of the fragmented tribalism to which we can so easily and devastatingly regress. Once the social world has forced the child to integrate his multiple sub-personalities, he can play with others. After that, he should be ready to engage in the more serious games that make up jobs or professions with their highly structured expectations, skills, and rules. He must learn those, as well as, when older, the dance of the sexes. He must integrate his socialized personality with that of another so that the couple he makes with that other can exist together peacefully, productively, within society over the long term. while maintaining voluntary willingness to do so. This is the dual process of psychological and social integration that accompanies apprenticeship, all associated with the outsourcing of sanity. Adherence to this process will make him a socially sophisticated, productive, and psychologically healthy adult, capable of true reciprocity, and perhaps the temporary suspension of the demand of reciprocity necessary to raise children. But the story of integration and socialization does not end here. This is because two things are happening at once during an apprenticeship worthy of the name, just as learning to play a game and learning to be a good sport happen at the same time while playing. The apprentice must initially become a servant of tradition, of structure, and of dogma, just as the child who wants to play must follow the rules of the game. At its best, this servitude means grateful alliance in one form or another with the institutions typically considered patriarchal. Apprenticeship means heat and pressure. As new workmen are tried by their peers, as articling law students are tried by their employers, as medical residents are tried by physicians, nurses, and patients. The goal of this heat and pressure is subordination of an undeveloped personality, by no means individual at this point, to a single path for the purposes of transformation from undisciplined beginner to accomplished master. The master, who is the rightful product of apprenticeship, is, however, no longer the servant of dogma. Instead, he is now himself served by dogma, which he has the responsibility to maintain, as well as the right to change when change is necessary. This makes the master, who once allowed himself to be enslaved, an emergent follower of spirit, the wind, spirit, that bloweth where it listeth, John 3:8. The master can allow himself his intuitions, as the knowledge obtained by the discipline he has acquired will enable him to criticize his own ideas and assess their true value. He may, therefore, more clearly perceive the fundamental patterns or principles that underlie the dogmas of his discipline and draw inspiration from those, instead of blindly adhering to the rules as currently articulated or embodied. He may even rely on the integrated union of his personality and his training to modify or transform even those more fundamental, deeply intuited principles in the service of an even higher union. Dogma and spirit. The limiting disciplines that serve both as precondition for a game and for the development of a unity of being can usefully be considered thou shalt nots, rules that highlight what is definitely not to be done, while whatever is supposed to be done is taking place. Abiding by these rules produces a development of character, character with a particular nature or essence. We have already discussed this as, say, the development of personal desirability as a player of many games or sequences of games. As is the case in many other situations, it appears that this idea is already implicit in the stories that make up the bedrock of our culture. This is particularly evident in the Gospel of Mark, which is a commentary on what are among the most influential rules of the game ever formulated, the Mosaic Ten Commandments, and, even more broadly, a commentary on rules themselves. The commandments follow. 1. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. 2. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. 3. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. 4. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 5. Honor thy father and thy mother. 6. Thou shalt not kill. 7. Thou shalt not commit adultery. 8. Thou shalt not steal. 9. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. 10. Thou shalt not covet. The first speaks to the necessity of aiming at the highest possible unity. The second, to the danger of worshipping false idols, by confusing the representation or the image with the ineffable it is supposed to represent. The third means that it is wrong to claim moral inspiration from God while knowingly committing sinful acts. The fourth means that it is necessary to leave time to regularly consider what is truly valuable or sacred. The fifth keeps families together, mandating honor, respect, and gratitude from children as just reward for the sacrifices made by parents. The sixth prevents murder, obviously, but by doing so, also protects the community from potential descent into constant and potentially multi-generational feuding. The seventh mandates the sacredness of the marriage vow, predicated on the assumption, like the fifth, that the stability and value of the family is of paramount importance. The eighth allows for honest, hardworking people to reap the benefits of their efforts without fear that what they have produced will be taken from them arbitrarily, and, thereby, makes civilized society a possibility. The ninth maintains the integrity of the law, reducing or eliminating its use as a weapon. And the tenth is a reminder that envy and the resentment it breeds is a destructive force of the highest power. It is worthwhile thinking of these commandments as a minimum set of rules for a stable society, an iterable social game. The commandments are rules established in the book of Exodus and part of that unforgettable story. But they are also pointers to something else. Something that simultaneously emerges from and transcends the rules and constitutes their essence. The core idea is this: subjugate yourself voluntarily to a set of socially determined rules, those with some tradition in their formulation, and a unity that transcends the rules will emerge. The unity constitutes what you could be if you concentrate on a particular goal and see it through. There's a story relevant to this idea in the Gospel of Mark. The pertinent section begins with Christ journeying to the Temple of Jerusalem, where he casts out the money changers and merchants and addresses the crowd with an irresistible charisma. And, as the tale goes, the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people was astonished at his doctrine. Mark 11:18. In consequence, they begin to conspire, questioning this strange prophet, hoping to entice him into a heretical and therefore potentially fatal statement, sending to him certain of the Pharisees and of the Herodians to catch him in his words. Mark 12:13. Christ deals masterfully, to say the least, with the questioners, reducing them to an aggrieved and resentful silence. The section ends with what is arguably the most difficult and treacherous of questions posed by a particularly cunning but also perhaps begrudgingly admiring interlocutor. Mark 12:28-34. And one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together and perceiving that he had answered them well, asked him, "Which is the first commandment of all?" And Jesus answered him, "The first of all the commandments is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, and with all thy strength. This is the first commandment. And the second is like, namely this: thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. There is none other commandment greater than these.' And the scribe said unto him, 'Well, Master, thou hast said the truth, for there is one God, and there is none other but he. And to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love his neighbor as himself, is more than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices.' And when Jesus saw that he answered discreetly, he said unto him, 'Thou art not far from the kingdom of God.' And no man after that durst ask him any question." What does this all mean? The personality integrated by disciplined adherence to a set of appropriate rules is simultaneously, although perhaps unknowingly, guided by or imitating the highest possible ideal. precisely that ideal that constitutes whatever common element of moral makes all the rules good, just, and necessary. That ideal, according to Christ's answer, is something singular, the one Lord, thoroughly embodied, loved with all thy heart, soul, understanding, and strength, and then manifested as a love that is identical for self and all mankind. Western culture is unconsciously underpinned by a very profound drama reflecting all this because of its origin in Judeo-Christian conceptualization. Psychologically speaking, Christ is a representation or an embodiment of the mastery of dogma and the consequent emergence of spirit. Spirit is the creative force that gives rise to what becomes dogma with time. Spirit is also that which constantly transcends such time-honored tradition, when possible. It is for this reason that an apprenticeship ends with a masterpiece, the creation of which signifies not only the acquisition of the requisite skill, but the acquisition of the ability to create new skills. Although Christ commits many acts that might be considered revolutionary, as we discussed in Rule 1, he is nonetheless explicitly portrayed in the Gospels as the master of tradition, and says of himself, "Think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill." Matthew 5:17, KJV. The New International Version of the Bible perhaps puts it more comprehensibly. "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." Christ therefore presents himself as both the product of tradition and the very thing that creates and transforms it. The same pattern of creative conflict pervades the Old Testament, which is in large part a series of stories about the Spirit in prophetic opposition to the inevitable corruption of dogma harnessed to serve power. It is the personality who mimics that model who might be regarded as truly Western in the deepest of psychological senses. If you work as hard as you can on one thing, you will change. You will start to also become one thing instead of the clamoring multitude you once were. That one thing, developed properly, is not only the disciplined entity formed by sacrifice, commitment, and concentration. It is that which creates, destroys, and transforms discipline itself, civilization itself, by expressing its unity of personality and society. It is the very word of truth upon whose function all habitable order, wrenched out of chaos, eternally depends. Work as hard as you possibly can on at least one thing, and see what happens. Rule 8. Try to make one room in your home as beautiful as possible. Cleaning your room is not enough. I have become known for encouraging people to clean up their rooms. Perhaps that is because I am serious about that prosaic piece of advice, and because I know that it is a much more difficult task than it appears. I have been unsuccessfully cleaning up my room, by the way, my home office, which I generally keep in relatively pristine condition, for about 3 years now. My life was thrown into such chaos over that period by the multitude of changes I experienced: political controversies, transformation of career, endless travel, mountains of mail, the sequence of illnesses, that I simply became overwhelmed. The disorganization was heightened by the fact that my wife and I had just finished having much of our house renovated, and everything we could not find a proper place for ended up in my office. There is a meme floating around the internet accusing me of hypocrisy on account of this, a still taken from a video I shot in my office with a fair bit of mess in the background, and I cannot say that I look much better myself. Who am I to tell people to clean up their rooms before attempting to fix the rest of the world when, apparently, I cannot do it myself? And there is something directly synchronistic and meaningful about that objection, because I am not in proper order at that moment myself, and my condition undoubtedly found its reflection in the state of my office. more piled up every day as I traveled and everything collected around me. I plead exceptional circumstances, and I put many other things in order during the time my office was degenerating, but I still have a moral obligation to get back in there and put it right. And the problem is not just that I want to clean up the mess, I also want to make it beautiful, my room, my house, and then, perhaps, in whatever way I can manage, the community. God knows it is crying out for it. Making something beautiful is difficult, but it is amazingly worthwhile. If you learn to make something in your life truly beautiful, even one thing, then you have established a relationship with beauty. From there, you can begin to expand that relationship out into other elements of your life and the world. That is an invitation to the divine. That is the reconnection with the immortality of childhood and the true beauty and majesty of the being you can no longer see. You must be daring to try that. If you study art and literature and the humanities, you do it so that you can familiarize yourself with the collected wisdom of our civilization. This is a very good idea, a veritable necessity, because people have been working out how to live for a long time. What they have produced is strange, but also rich beyond comparison, so why not use it as a guide? Your vision will be grander and your plans more comprehensive. You will consider other people more intelligently and completely. You will take care of yourself more effectively. You will understand the present more profoundly, rooted as it is in the past, and you will come to conclusions much more carefully. You will come to treat the future as well as a more concrete reality, because you will have developed some true sense of time and be less likely to sacrifice it to impulsive pleasure. You will develop some depth, gravitas, and true thoughtfulness. You will speak more precisely, and other people will become more likely to listen to and cooperate productively with you, as you will with them. You will become more your own person, and less a dull and hapless tool of peer pressure, vogue, fad, and ideology. Buy a piece of art. Find one that speaks to you, and make the purchase. If it is a genuine artistic production, it will invade your life and change it. A real piece of art is a window into the transcendent, and you need that in your life, because you are finite and limited and bounded by your ignorance. Unless you can make a connection to the transcendent, you will not have the strength to prevail when the challenges of life become daunting. You need to establish a link with what is beyond you, like a man overboard in high seas requires a life preserver, and the invitation of beauty into your life is one means by which that may be accomplished. It is for such reasons that we need to understand the role of art and stop thinking about it as an option or a luxury, or worse, an affectation. Art is the bedrock of culture itself. It is the foundation of the process by which we unite ourselves psychologically and come to establish productive peace with others. As it is said, "Man shall not live by bread alone." Matthew 4:4. That is exactly right. We live by beauty. We live by literature. We live by art. We cannot live without some connection to the divine, and beauty is divine, because in its absence life is too short, too dismal, and too tragic. And we must be sharp and awake and prepared so that we can survive properly and orient the world properly and not destroy things, including ourselves. And beauty can help us appreciate the wonder of being and motivate us to seek gratitude when we might otherwise be prone to destructive resentment. Memory and vision. The pride of the peacock is the glory of God. The lust of the goat is the bounty of God. The wrath of the lion is the wisdom of God. The nakedness of woman is the work of God. Excess of sorrow laughs. Excess of joy weeps. The roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea and the destructive sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. William Blake, from Proverbs of Hell, the marriage of heaven and hell. When I was a child, I knew the contours and details of all the houses in my immediate neighborhood. I knew the back alleys, the places behind the fences, the location of each crack in the pavement, and the shortcuts that could be taken from one place to another. My geographical locale was not large, but I had explored it thoroughly, and my knowledge of it was very detailed. Now that I am an adult, the same is not true. I lived in Fairview, the town I grew up in for most of my childhood and adolescence, for only 9 years, but I am still able to picture in high resolution the street I lived on. I have lived in Toronto, on the same street, for more than twice as long, but I still have only a vague sense of the houses that surround mine. I do not think that is a good thing. I feel far less at home because of it. It is as if when I walk down the street and glance at a local house, I think of house as an icon. Because really, what practical difference does it make to me what particularities characterize each house? And then my attention is turned to something else. I do not see the house, with its specific shingles, colors, flowers, and architectural details, despite the interest that might have been elicited in me had I paid careful attention. By this point in my life, I have seen so many houses in so many places that I know what a house is likely to do when I walk by it, which is very little. Thus, I ignore the engaging idiosyncrasies and beauties of its details, its unique character, for better or worse, and see just enough to stay oriented as I walk past and continue to think and be elsewhere as I do so. There is real loss in that. I am simply not there in my adult neighborhood, the same way I was as a child in my hometown. I am separated from the reality of the world. And a very deep feeling of belonging is missing in some important way because of that. Perception has been replaced for me with functional, pragmatic memory. This has made me more efficient in some ways, but the cost is an impoverished experience of the richness of the world. I remember when I started working as a junior professor in Boston when my kids were about 2 and 3 years old. I was very preoccupied with my work, trying to keep up, trying to advance my career, trying to make enough money to support my family on a single income. I would come home and take a walk with Tammy and our children, Michaela and Julian. I found it very difficult to remain patient with them. I had too much work to do, always, or believed I did, and had disciplined myself through years of effort to focus continually on that. If we went for a walk, I wanted to know exactly where we were going, just how long it would take to get there, and precisely when we were going back. This is no attitude to adopt when trying to have a pleasant and reasonable time with toddlers, not if you want to immerse yourself in the experience, not if you want to watch and participate in the pleasure they take in their timeless discovery, not unless you want to risk missing something of crucial import. It was very difficult for me to relax and focus on the present and watch my little kids pursue their meandering route through the neighborhood with no particular destination, purpose, or schedule in mind, engaging themselves deeply in an encounter with a local dog, bug, or earthworm, or in some game they invented on the way. Now and then, however, I could snap briefly into that same frame of reference. That is one of the wonderful gifts provided by young children, and see the pristine world they inhabited, still untrammeled by practiced and efficient memory, capable of producing pure joy in the newness of everything. But I was still possessed enough by my future concerns to be involuntarily pulled back into intense preoccupation with getting the next thing done. I knew perfectly well that I was missing out on beauty and meaning and engagement, regardless of whatever advantages in efficiency my impatience brought. I was narrow, sharp, and focused, and did not waste time. But the price I paid for that was the blindness demanded by efficiency, accomplishment, and order. I was no longer seeing the world. I was seeing only the little I needed to navigate it with maximum speed and lowest cost. None of that was surprising. I had the responsibilities of an adult. I had a demanding job. I had to take care of my family. And that meant sacrificing the present and attending to the future. But having little children around and noticing their intense preoccupation with the present and their fascination with what was directly around them made me very conscious of the loss that accompanied maturity. Great poets are expressly aware of this, and they do what they can to remind the rest of us. There was a time when meadow, grove, and stream, the earth, and every common sight, to me did seem apparelled in celestial light, the glory and the freshness of a dream. It is not now, as it hath been of yore, turn wheresoever I may, by night or day. The things which I have seen, I now can see no more. Ye blessed creatures, I have heard the call ye to each other make. I see the heavens laugh with you in your jubilee. My heart is at your festival. My head hath its coronal. The fullness of your bliss, I feel. I feel it all. Oh, evil day! If I were sullen while earth herself is adorning this sweet May morning, and the children are calling on every side, in a thousand valleys far and wide, fresh flowers, while the sun shines warm, and the babe leaps up on his mother's arm, I hear, with joy I hear. But there's a tree, of many one, a single field which I have looked upon. Both of them speak of something that is gone. The pansy at my feet doth the same tale repeat. Whither is fled the visionary gleam? Where is it now, the glory and the dream? William Wordsworth, Ode, Intimations of Immortality, from Recollections of Early Childhood. Some, in fact, never lose the glorious vision of childhood. This is particularly true of artists, and indeed seems a vital part of what makes them artists. William Blake, the English painter, printmaker, and poet, appears to have been one such person. He inhabited a uniquely visionary world. Blake perceived something closer to what the philosopher Immanuel Kant termed the thing in itself than do most mortals, left as we are with the pale reflection of our surroundings that our increasingly restricted mature perceptions deliver to us. Blake was also exquisitely sensitive to the metaphoric or dramatic significance of each apparently isolated event, the manner in which each event is rife with endless poetically echoing connotations. Every farmer understands every tear from every eye becomes a babe in eternity. This is caught by females bright and returned to its own delight. The bleat, the bark, bellow and roar are waves that beat on heaven's shore. The babe that weeps the rod beneath writes revenge in realms of death. The beggar's rags, fluttering in air, does to rags the heavens tear. The soldier, armed with sword and gun, palsied, strikes the summer's sun. The poor man's farthing is worth more than all the gold on Afric's shore. One mite wrung from the laborer's hands shall buy and sell the miser's lands. Or, if protected from on high, does that whole nation sell and buy. He who mocks the infant's faith shall be mocked in age and death. He who shall teach the child to doubt, the rotting grave shall ne'er get out. He who respects the infant's faith triumphs over hell and death. William Blake, Auguries of Innocence, lines 67 to 90. The vision of a true artist such as Blake is truly too much, because what is beyond our memory-restricted perceptions is too much. It is the unfathomable totality of the world, past, present, and future, bound up together, every level connected to every other level, nothing existing in isolation, everything implying something vital but beyond our comprehension, and all of it speaking of the overwhelming mystery of being. The visionary concentrates on something we all see, hypothetically. A vase of flowers, perhaps, in all its complexity and beauty, each bloom springing forth out of nothingness before its dissolution and return. A haystack in the spring, and its appearance in the summer, autumn, and winter, observing and portraying the absolute mystery of its existence with its different shades of light and color, as well as the underlying commonality of form, which we can easily confuse with the full and incomprehensible actuality of what is there. How do you know but every bird that cuts the airy way is an immense world of delight, closed by your senses five? William Blake, from A Memorable Fancy, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. To perceive Van Gogh's painting, Irises, from which the illustration that begins this chapter is derived, is, for example, to gaze through a window back into the eternity that our perceptions once revealed, so that we can remember how awe-inspiring and miraculous the world really is, under the mundane familiarity to which we have reduced it. To share in the artist's perception reunites us with the source of inspiration that can rekindle our delight in the world, even if the drudgery and repetition of daily life has reduced what we see to the narrowest and most pragmatic of visions. But for those first affections, those shadowy recollections, which, be they what they may, are yet the fountain light of all our day, are yet a master light of all our seeing, uphold us, cherish, and have power to make our noisy years seem moments in the being of the eternal silence, truths that wake to perish never, which neither listlessness, nor mad endeavor, nor man, nor boy, nor all that is at enmity with joy can utterly abolish or destroy. William Wordsworth, Ode, Intimations of Immortality from Recollections of Early Childhood. All of this is very frightening. It is frightening to perceive the shells of ourselves that we have become. It is frightening to glimpse, even for a moment, the transcendent reality that exists beyond. We think we border our great paintings with luxurious, elaborate frames to glorify them. But we do it at least as much to insist to ourselves that the glory of the painting itself ends at the frame. That bounding, that bordering, leaves the world we are familiar with comfortably intact and unchanged. We do not want that beauty reaching out past the limitations imposed on it and disturbing everything that is familiar. We do the same with museums, those asylums for genius. We isolate everything that is great, everything that could, in principle, be distributed throughout the world. Why cannot every small town have a shrine devoted to one great piece of art, instead of having every piece collected in a manner impossible for anyone ever to take in at once? Is not one masterpiece enough for a room, or even for a building? 10 great works of art, or 100, in a single room is absurd, given that each is a world in and of itself. Such mass collection is a degrading of the unique, singular particularity and worth of what is priceless and irreplaceable. It is fear that entices us to imprison art, and no wonder. Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself. Walt Whitman, Song of Myself. It can be overwhelming to open ourselves up to the beauty in the world that we as adults have painted over with simplicity. In not doing so, however, in not taking a proper walk with a young child, for example, we lose track of the grandeur and the awe the untrammeled world is constantly capable of producing, and reduce our lives to bleak necessity. the land you know, the land you do not know, and the land you cannot even imagine. You inhabit the land you know, pragmatically and conceptually. But imagine what lies just outside of that. There exists an immense space of things you do not know, but which other people might comprehend, at least in part. Then, outside of what anyone knows, there is the space of things that no one at all knows. Your world is known territory, surrounded by the relatively unknown, surrounded by the absolutely unknown, surrounded, even more distantly, by the absolutely unknowable. Together, that is the canonical archetypal landscape. The unknown manifests itself to you in the midst of the known. That revelation, sometimes exciting but often quite painful, is the source of new knowledge. But a fundamental question remains. How is that knowledge generated? What is comprehended and understandable does not just leap in one fell swoop from the absolutely unknown to the thoroughly and self-evidently articulated. Knowledge must pass through many stages of analysis, a multitude of transformations, before it becomes, let us say, commonplace. The first stage is that of pure action, reflex action, at the most basic of levels. If something surprises you, you react to it first with your body. You crouch defensively or freeze or run away in panic. Those are all forms of representation and categorization in nascent form. Crouch means predatory attack. Freeze means predatory threat. Panic means terror necessitating escape. The world of possibility begins to actualize itself with such instinctual embodied action, unconscious and uncontrollable. The first realization of possibility, of potential, is not conceptual. It is embodied, but it is still representational. It is no longer the thing in itself we referred to earlier, but the transmutation of that thing into a commensurate physical response. That is a representation. Maybe you are at home, at night. Assume you are alone. It is dark and late. An unexpected noise startles you, and you freeze. That is the first transmutation. Unknown noise, a pattern, to frozen position. Then, your heart rate rises in preparation for unspecified action. That is the second transmutation. You are preparing to move. Next, your imagination populates the darkness with whatever might be making the noise. That is the third transmutation, part of a complete and practical sequence. Embodied responses, freezing and heart rate increase, and then imagistic, imaginative representation. The latter is part of exploration, which you might extend by overcoming your terror and the freezing associated with it, assuming nothing else too unexpected happens, and investigating the locale, once a part of your friendly house, from where the noise appeared to emanate. You have now engaged in active exploration, a precursor to direct perception, hopefully nothing too dramatic, then to explicit knowledge of the source, and then back to routine and complacent peace, if the noise proves to be nothing of significance. That is how information moves from the unknown to the known. Except that sometimes the noise does not prove insignificant. Then there is trouble. Artists are the people who stand on the frontier of the transformation of the unknown into knowledge. They make their voluntary foray out into the unknown, and they take a piece of it and transform it into an image. Maybe they do it through choreography and dance, by representing the manifestation of the world in physical display, communicable, although not in words, to others. Maybe they do it by acting, which is a sophisticated form of embodiment and imitation, or by painting or sculpting. Perhaps they manage it through screenwriting or by penning a novel. After all that, come the intellectuals with philosophy and criticism, abstracting and articulating the work's representations and rules. Consider the role that creative people play in cities. They are typically starving a bit, because it is virtually impossible to be commercially successful as an artist, and that hunger is partly what motivates them. Do not underestimate the utility of necessity. In their poverty, they explore the city, and they discover some ratty, quasi-criminal area that has seen better days. They visit, look, and poke about, and they think, you know, with a little work, this area could be cool. Then they move in, piece together some galleries, and put up some art. They do not make any money, but they civilize the space a bit. In doing so, they elevate and transform what is too dangerous into something cutting edge. Then a coffee shop pops up and maybe an unconventional clothing store. The next thing you know, the gentrifiers move in. They are creative types too, but more conservative. Less desperate, perhaps. More risk-averse, at least, so they are not the first ones on the edge of the frontier. Then the developers show up, and then the chain stores appear, and the middle or upper class establishes itself. Then the artists have to move because they can no longer afford the rent. That is a loss for the avant-garde. But it is okay, even though it is harsh, because with all that stability and predictability, the artists should not be there anymore. They need to rejuvenate some other area. They need another vista to conquer. That is their natural environment. That edge, where artists are always transforming chaos into order, can be a very rough and dangerous place. Living there, an artist constantly risks falling fully into the chaos instead of transforming it. But artists have always lived there, on the border of human understanding. Art bears the same relationship to society that the dream bears to mental life. You are very creative when you are dreaming. That is why when you remember a dream, you think, where in the world did that come from? It is very strange and incomprehensible that something can happen in your head and you have no idea how it got there or what it means. It is a miracle, nature's voice manifesting itself in your psyche, and it happens every night. Like art, the dream mediates between order and chaos, so it is half chaos. That is why it is not comprehensible. It is a vision, not a fully fledged articulated production. Those who actualize those half-born visions into artistic productions are those who begin to transform what we do not understand into what we can at least start to see. That is the role of the artist, occupying the vanguard. That is their biological niche. They are the initial civilizing agents. The artists do not understand full well what they are doing. They cannot if they are doing something genuinely new. Otherwise, they could just say what they mean and have done with it. They would not require expression in dance, music, and image. But they are guided by feel, by intuition, by their facility with the detection of patterns, and that is all embodied rather than articulated, at least in its initial stages. When creating, the artists are struggling, contending, and wrestling with a problem, maybe even a problem they do not fully understand, and striving to bring something new into clear focus. Otherwise, they are mere propagandists, reversing the artistic process, attempting to transform something they can already articulate into image and art for the purpose of rhetorical and ideological victory. That is a great sin, harnessing the higher for the purposes of the lower. It is a totalitarian tactic, the subordination of art and literature to politics, or the purposeful blurring of the distinction between them. Artists must be contending with something they do not understand, or they are not artists. Instead, they are posers, or romantics, often romantic failures, or narcissists, or actors, and not in the creative sense. They are likely, when genuine, to be idiosyncratically and peculiarly obsessed by their intuition, possessed by it, willing to pursue it even in the face of opposition and the overwhelming likelihood of rejection, criticism, and practical and financial failure. When they are successful, they make the world more understandable, sometimes replacing something once understood, but now anachronistic, with something new and better. They move the unknown closer to the conscious, social, and articulated world. And then people gaze at those artworks, watch the drama, and listen to the stories, and they start to become informed by them, but they do not know how or why, and people find great value in it, more value, perhaps, than in anything else. There is good reason that the most expensive artifacts in the world, those that are literally or close to literally priceless, are great works of art. I once visited the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It contained a collection of great and famous Renaissance paintings, each worth hundreds of millions of dollars, assuming they were ever made available for purchase. The area containing them was a shrine, a place of the divine, for believers and atheists alike. It was in the most expensive and prestigious of museums, located on real estate of the highest quality and desirability, in what might well be the most active and exciting city in the world. The collection had been put together over a great expanse of time and with much difficulty. The gallery was packed with people, many of whom had voyaged there, as part of what must be most properly regarded as a pilgrimage. I asked myself, what are these people up to, coming to this place so carefully curated, traveling these great distances, looking at these paintings? And what do they believe they are up to? One painting featured the Immaculate Conception of Mary, brilliantly composed. The Mother of God was rising to heaven in a beatific state, encapsulated in a mandorla of clouds embedded with the faces of Putti. Many of the gathered people were gazing, enraptured, at the work. I thought, they do not know what that painting means. They do not understand the symbolic meaning of the mandorla or the significance of the Putti, or the idea of the glorification of the Mother of God. And God, after all, is dead, or so goes the story. Why does this painting nonetheless retain its value? Why is it in this room, in this building, with these other paintings, in this city, carefully guarded, not to be touched? Why is this painting and all these others beyond price and desired by those who already have everything? Why are these creations stored so carefully in a modern shrine and visited by people from all over the world as if it were a duty, even as if it were desirable or necessary? We treat these objects as if they are sacred. At least that is what our actions in their vicinity suggest. We gaze at them in ignorance and wonder and remember what we have forgotten, perceiving ever so dimly what we can no longer see, what we are perhaps no longer willing to see. The unknown shines through the productions of great artists in partially articulated form. The awe-inspiring ineffable begins to be realized, but retains a terrifying abundance of its transcendent power. That is the role of art, and that is the role of artists. It is no wonder we keep their dangerous, magical productions locked up, framed, and apart from everything else. And if a great piece is damaged anywhere, the news spreads worldwide. We feel a tremor run through the bedrock of our culture. The dream upon which our reality depends shakes and moves. We find ourselves unnerved. One room. I live with my wife in a small, semi-detached house, with a living room that cannot be larger than 12 feet by 12 feet. But we work to make that room extremely beautiful while endeavoring to do the same with the rest of the house. In the living room hung some large paintings, not to everyone's taste, certainly. They were Soviet realist/impressionist pieces, some illustrating the Second World War, some representing the triumph of communism, as well as a variety of Cubist miniatures and South American pieces heavily influenced by the native tradition. Prior to our recent renovations, the room had held at least 25 paintings, including about 15 smaller pieces, 12 inches by 12 inches. There was even one, reminiscent of a medieval etching, although painted on canvas, on the ceiling, where I had attached it with magnets. It was from a Romanian church. The largest was 6 feet high and about 8 feet wide. I know perfectly well that aggregating all these paintings together in such a small space contradicts my earlier point about devoting a room or even a building to a single work of art. But I have only a single house, so I plead necessity. If I wanted to collect paintings, they had to be put where I was able to put them. In the rest of the house, We used 36 different colors and a variety of different glosses on the walls and the trim throughout the building, all from a palette that matched a large realist painting of a railway yard in Chicago in the 1950s, created by the same artist who helped us plan and then renovate our home. I bought the Soviet pieces on eBay from Ukrainian junk dealers specializing in Soviet-era artifacts. At one point, I had a network of about 20 people in the Ukraine sending me photographs of whatever paintings they had scrounged from the ruins of the Soviet bureaucracy. Most were awful, but some were amazing. I have a great painting, for example, of Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space, standing in front of a rocket and a radar installation, and another from the 1970s of a lonesome soldier writing his mother in front of a large radio. It is really something to see relatively modern events memorialized in oil by talented artists. The Soviets kept their academies functioning continuously from the 19th century onward, and, although tremendous restrictions were placed on what could be produced, those who passed through them became highly skilled painters. The Soviet paintings eventually took over our house. Most of them were small and insanely inexpensive, and I bought dozens of them. The Soviet era produced its own impressionism, often depicting landscapes rougher and harsher than the classic French versions, but much to my taste and reminiscent of where I grew up in Western Canada. While seeking them out, I exposed myself to a larger number of paintings, I like to think, than anyone else in history. For at least 4 years, starting in 2001, I searched eBay, looking at roughly 1,000 paintings a day, seeking the one or two in that number that were of genuine quality. It was most often a Russian or Soviet landscape selling for a song, better paintings than I had ever seen in galleries or museum collections in Toronto. I would place them in a list of items I was interested in, an eBay feature, print them out, lay them on the floor, and then ask my wife Tammy to help me narrow my choices. She has a good eye and a fair bit of training as an artist. We would discard anything we found to be flawed and purchase what remained. Because of this, my kids grew up surrounded by art, and it certainly left an impression. Many of my paintings now hang in their respective dwellings. They tended to avoid the more political Soviet propaganda, which I was interested in because of its historical significance and because of the ongoing war on the canvases between art, a consequence of the painter's undeniable talent, and the propaganda that art was doomed to serve. I can tell you that the art shines through the propaganda as the years pass by. That is something very interesting to observe. I also tried, at about that time, to make my university office beautiful. After I was transferred from an office I had already put some work into, the same artist who helped redesign the interior of our house, and from whom I also purchased many large paintings, which also hang in our house, tried to help me transform my new factory-like, fluorescent-lit catastrophe of a 1970s sealed windows hellhole office into something that someone with some sense could sit in for 30 years without wanting to die. Faculty members were forbidden to undertake any major modifications to these spaces due to union requirements or administration interpretations of those requirements. So, my artist friend and I devised an alternate plan. We decided to insert some heavy nickel-plated hooks into the cinder block, in pairs about 4 feet apart and 7 feet above the ground, and then to hang from those hooks good 3/4-inch sanded and stained wood sheets with cherry veneer on one side. Voila! Wood-paneled office, for the cost of about 8 $75 pieces of plywood, plus some labor. We were going to install these on a weekend when there was no one else around. Then we planned to paint the drop ceilings, carefully as asbestos lurked above the tiles. Hell is a place of drop ceilings, rusted ventilation grates, and fluorescent lights. The dismal ugliness and dreariness and general depression of spirit that results from these cost-saving features no doubt suppresses productivity far more than the cheapest of architectural tricks and the most deadening of lights saves money. Everyone looks like a corpse under fluorescence, penny-wise and pound-foolish indeed. We were going to paint the ceiling with a paint called Hammerite, which looks like beaten metal once it dries. That would have transformed the unavoidable industrial aesthetic, which can be attractive if handled wisely, into something thoughtful and unique. This could also have been done for minimal cost. A good carpet, perhaps Persian, also very inexpensive on eBay, some reasonably high-quality curtains, and a decent industrial desk. One weekend of secretive work, and an office that a civilized person could inhabit without resentment and self-contempt. But I made a fatal error. I spoke to one of the senior administrators of the psychology department about my plans. She and I had previously discussed the sheer ugliness of the floor our area inhabited and the dismal state of all the offices, and I thought we had established consensus that improvement was warranted. I assumed she was on board. We'd even talked about transforming her corner office. I began to excitedly share my intentions. She looked displeased instead of happy and said, unexpectedly, "You cannot do that." I shook my head in disbelief and thought, "What? I am planning to make something exceedingly ugly better, quickly, with no trouble, for no money to speak of, and you're